such a wonderful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way.
Ray Charles singing, "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning." First of the beautiful songs of Rodgers and Hammerstein in the musical Oklahoma. Michael Bourne with you. Ted Chapin is with me again. I think your fifth time.
I'm honored.
The boss at Rodgers and Hammerstein and the one who says, okay, you can do that, or no, you can't. So we're going to talk about the new Broadway revival of Oklahoma, but I just have to observe that 50 years ago, I first came to New York, and one of the things to do was to go to Woodstock, but the other thing was to actually see a Broadway musical on actual Broadway.
Right.
And the first one I saw was Oklahoma at the State Theater of Lincoln Center, produced by Richard Rodgers, and that's when Lincoln Center was run by your father.
He was the vice president of programming. And I'm sorry that the music theater of Lincoln Center is no longer. When they put Lincoln Center together, it was around three big performing art institutions, opera, ballet, and concert music. But there was no straight theater and no musical theater. At that time in New York in the 50s, theater and musical theater was completely Broadway. So they created the Repertory Theater of Lincoln Center, which after many stumbling years has now become one of the foremost theaters in the country, Lincoln Center Theater, and then the Music Theater of Lincoln Center for the State Theater that Richard Rodgers ran. And it's the first place I saw The King and I. It's the first place I saw. I had actually seen Oklahoma at City Center with John Davidson during the City Center's era of doing musicals.
They used to do that,
spring.
Yes. It's, for me, the great moment was right at the very beginning because the curtain opens up and there's this wide open stage, and right in the middle is this little old lady churning butter, and it was the Wicked Witch.
Okay.
It was Margaret Hamilton.
Right.
And everybody went nuts right away from the beginning, because all of a sudden everybody, you didn't look at the program.
The Wicked Witch.
Oh! That's the Wicked Witch.
There's actually a little piece of film. There's that Leroy Reams, who was Will Parker in that production, hounded me for years about a television show that was done about Lincoln Center. And he said, we did Kansas City. And it took me a long time, but I found it. It's absolutely fascinating. A black and white Saturday morning television show about the complex of Lincoln Center. Lorne Greene is the host. There's a little bit of ballet, a little bit of opera. And then in front of the fountain, in front of the Beaumont, the sculpture that Peter Ustinov referred to as looking like an elephant that was trying to relieve itself hard that it broke in two.
Yes.
But anyway, you can see glimpses of the Wicked Witch of the West, and you can see Kansas City is danced by Leroy Reams.
We're going to talk about Kansas City and more about Oklahoma, new on Broadway. I'm going to play some of the great songs because so many great songs came out of the show. They innovated Rodgers and Hammerstein in incorporating songs and ballets into the plot, into the characters. And yet, out of this show, except maybe for The King and I think out of Oklahoma, there are more songs that have been plucked over the years by cabaret singers, by jazz singers, by other singers.
They're a pretty amazing collection of songs.
And Sorry with the Fringe on Top, it's a song about a buggy.
Right. Well.
Or something to that effect.
I think Lena Horne taught us that it was about something else.
Well, there is that. And then you know that the twist is it became a standard for jazz cats to play. And I think, we know the Miles Davis, but the Miles Davis was inspired by Ahmad Jamal. You've heard that?
Uh-huh, I have.
You're going to hear it again right now on WBGO.
and just keep a creeping with a slow clip, clap. Don't you hurry with the surrey, scurry with the surrey, pretty little surrey with a fringe on top.
Chicks and ducks and geese scurrying. Is there another song you could think of or ever have heard with isinglass in it?
No, not at all. Not at all. But that's part, you know, part of the brilliance of Oscar Hammerstein was taking the source material, whatever it was, because it's different in all of their shows, and using it. There's a lot of Lynn Riggs, who wrote Green Grow the Lilacs in Oklahoma, including the word isinglass, I believe, is in Green Grow the Lilacs. And to figure out how to use it in a lyric is a pretty masterful stroke.
But Oscar Hammerstein knew how to do that.
He did. He did.
I'm talking with Ted Chapin from the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization. And just then, Imad Jamal and Lena Horne singing about... that buggy. Sometimes in shows, the buggy actually shows up on stage.
Yes, it does. It does.
Not in this new production.
Not much shows up in this new production on stage. A lot's left to your imagination.
And some is not left to your imagination.
Yes.
I mean, we're not going to be adversarial about this, but there were some things about that show that were wonderful. Mary Testa is always solid in everything she does. Everything is better that she's in. She's playing Ann Eller.
Yeah.
But and the Holly Hakeem is funny.
Yeah.
He's one of the funniest I've ever seen.
He's very good.
And yet they've done things with Judd Fry. They've changed him. And the weirdest thing is the ballet.
Yes.
And you know where I'm going with this. I mean, you and I have talked many times about the legend of Richard Rodgers not liking jazz because they changed his music.
Right.
And your friend, Mary Rodgers, told me that that's not true, that he did not dislike jazz, that he got nuts when people changed things in the show.
Right.
You can't get more changed
than what's in this production. I will say this. As you know, I was tapped to run the Rodgers and Hammerstein office by Mary Rodgers, and my first boss was Dorothy Rodgers, her mother, a formidable woman, and Bill Hammerstein, oldest son of Oscar. It's been a number of years, and in 2008, the family sold the business to a Dutch company, which then, thankfully, sold it to a very smart American company called Concord. But this is the first production on Broadway that there were no family members around to pass judgment one way or the other. So the responsibility fell to on my shoulders. And that was a little odd because, you know, different people own it. They don't necessarily have a point of view the way the families did. So, you know, the name of the game is to try to encourage things. I mean, Ariana Grande's version of My Favorite Things that came out recently, you know, is something that goes a far distance from what My Favorite Things was. And this production of Oklahoma goes a far distance from what we think about Oklahoma.
The second act opens with, traditionally, there's a dream ballet in which Curly and Laurie are dancing and Judd shows up and it gets violent. And it's Agnes DeMille.
Right.
And for years, Agnes DeMille's dances were also supposed to be done step for step in productions. In this, the young woman runs around the stage and does some somersaults wearing a T-shirt that says Dream Baby Dream. And a guy with a guitar like Jimi Hendrix playing feedback is playing Oh, What a Beautiful Morning. And I just kept thinking, Richard Rodgers, you know, the ghost is going to come down and be angry.
Well, probably me first. The ghost will come to me first and say,
why did you let them do this?
But I will simply say that first of all, you know, you never can tell what's going to happen in the theater. This production, the producer at Bard College came and asked about doing this production in 2015. And I said yes because it sounded interesting. There were things about that production up there that were interesting. It was very dark. One of the notes that I gave the director at that time was don't undermine the humor that's in this show. And what was fascinating, after Bard, there was interest in bringing it to New York. And I think everybody else said, this is not a Broadway show. So somewhere like, you know, the St. Anne's Warehouse was where it fit better because it, you know, it's kind of a downtown thinking show. And one of the smart things they did was hire Ally Stroker to play Ado Annie, who is in a wheelchair.
And she's wonderful.
Well, but she's a musical comedy babe.
And I mean, she's the friskiest Ado Annie I've ever seen.
And she knows exactly what that song is about. And I feel that when she came to be part of the cast, suddenly everybody realized, sort of back to the first note that I had given Daniel Fish, which was, there's some laughs to be gotten here. And especially if you're going to do a production as Daniel wants to, that really explores the dark side of that territory and that time of our history and what was going on, the more laughs, the better. And also, he said of Mary Testa, of your friend Mary Testa, if there's a laugh in the neighborhood, she'll know where to find it.
I mean, Ado, in the wheelchair, she's spinning and dancing.
Yeah, she knows exactly what she's doing. And there was, I have to say, there was a lot of conversation about the ballet. It usually happens at the end of the first act. The first act of Oklahoma is long by the clock. It was an era where that didn't matter to people. Audiences today are less willing to take a long show. So in Bard, they cut it entirely. So the ballet that exists now is a cut down version and changed version of what was in Brooklyn. And I pushed as hard as I could to make it something that I thought would be more user-friendly. And as part of my job, and it's a judgment call, but you know, halfway through previews, the director asked to have a meeting with me, and with the kind of passion that only a director can muster, he talked about how much he wanted to keep the ballet as you saw it. And I sat there thinking to myself, well, you know, there is a moment in our lives where we invoke what I call the life is too short clause.
Yeah.
And that's like, okay, you know what? There are other things in this production that needed to be attended to. And at this point, I'm going to say, yes, you can do the ballet here. This production is supposed to go out on tour. And I think the jury will be out as to what the ballet will end up being on tour. But again, you know, watch this space in a couple of years.
Again, Ally Stroker is just wonderful as Ado Annie. And here's the song that she sings. It's from the Karen Allison album of Rodgers and Hammerstein songs. She Can't Say No.
I'm just a fool when lights are low. I can't be prissy and quaint. I ain't the type that can faint. How can I be what I ain't? I can't say no.
Karen Allison from an album called Many a New Day. It's all Rodgers and Hammerstein songs with Kenny Barron on the piano and John Patitucci on the bass. And this is a wonderful album. She played Nellie Forbush once upon a time. I just knew she was in one of these shows. And that was it. Of course, it's perfect.
Get it in your DNA and they're there.
It's always in there. I am with Ted Chapin of the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization. And we're talking. We're not arguing really at all, which is a good thing. Your friend, I mean, your classmate, I think, Frank Rich, right?
He wasn't a classmate. He was at Harvard. My connection with him was that he wrote an extraordinary review of Follies in Boston at the Crimson. I was a gopher on the show.
Ted's book about Follies is the best book I've ever read about how a show comes together.
Oh, thank you. How much will that cost? No.
tell him it's called
Everything Was Possible. Yeah. But when Frank and I met years later, because he was doing a piece on Stephen Sondheim and Oscar Hammerstein, and he was the chief drama critic of the New York Times, and a classmate of his, Jack Vertel, put the two of us together. And, you know, it was one of those lunches that was going to be slightly awkward or not, and the first thing I said was about his review of In the Harvard Crimson of Follies, and within like 30 seconds, we became two Follies mavens trading stories about what changes were made in Boston and when. So, yeah, no, Frank is a friend. And he wrote, I have to say, he saw this Oklahoma in Brooklyn, and he called me, and he was effusive in his praise of it. And he said, I'm going to write an essay for New York Magazine if I have the time, because he's now doing some extraordinary television producing. And he did. He wrote a very, very interesting article.
The title was something like, Oklahoma Was Never Okay.
Right, right.
Something like that.
Right.
And it's all about the darkness in the Lynn Riggs play, Green Grow the Lilac.
And also darkness. And it's interesting. I was actually this morning, because we're doing a Lyrics and Lyricist about Oklahoma next week, I realized, because I was looking at something specific, both Lynn Riggs and Oscar Hammerstein refer to this play, Oklahoma, taking place in Indian territory. And neither play nor musical makes any reference to what we now refer to as Native Americans.
Right.
They're just like not there, although they both call it Indian territory. I thought that was interesting.
The twist is, there's all this gender blind casting now happening, and there's always been colorblind casting, or at least for years and years
right.
and years. And so historically, actually, in Oklahoma, most of the cowboys were African American.
Yeah, there are a lot of them.
And so that's no, the sheriff in this show is a black
man. Yeah.
But the weird thing about this show, and I've always felt, is that the last half is this long trial.
Right.
Why are they bothering to have this trial? And the way Frank Rich pointed it out is he's probably guilty.
Right.
And they're, that's the twist about Judd Fry,
yeah.
this character who I've seen played, Shuler Hensley was wonderful, but he was playing him like he was mentally
right.
challenged, what the R word. The,
right.
But not this kid. This kid is, he's just a loser.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that Patrick Vale, who plays Judd in this production, was an undergraduate at Bard. He was in the student production that Daniel Fish did years before he did the one. He's the one person who's been consistently through the whole show. And it's a very, very interesting, I mean, if you agree with it or not, it's a very interesting take on Judd. And again, what I think, I will defend it to this extent. When directors look at the text and see the words that Oscar Hammerstein wrote and decide to take an angle at what those words actually mean, it's fascinating. More people have seen this production and asked me, where did all those words come from? Did they pull from somewhere else? And the answer is no, they're all there. It's just a question of whether you're going to emphasize this part or that part. And that's where I think Daniel has done a kind of remarkable job.
Nuance.
Yeah, nuance.
It's always about that. Well, I've never asked you this. We've talked about this question of whether or not Rogers disliked people making changes.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about Oscar Hammerstein? Did he get weird if anybody makes a change in one of his books?
It's interesting. There's a lot of documentation of changing lyrics, like that when Hollywood thought that June Is Busting Out All Over was way too sexy. So he had to change lyrics. So there are letters of him writing, sort of neutralized lyrics for some of his things. Because I think for Hollywood. So I think he didn't, I think he was okay with that.
What lyric was too sexy in that song?
The rams that chase the ewe sheep are determined they'll be new sheep. Don't you understand what the rams and the ewes are doing, Mr.
Yes.
Censor in Hollywood, 1954?
Yes.
I know it's great. I mean, one interesting thing. I will give you this challenge: the original lyric in "You'll Never Walk Alone" in Carousel is "Keep your chin up high," and then people started to sing "Hold your head up high."
Ah,
when you walk through a storm, keep your chin up high, hold your head up high. I actually asked Steve Sondheim once which he thought was right, because it seems as if in the 50s, hold your head up high became more the norm than keep your chin up high. And when Amy Ash put together the complete lyrics of Oscar Hammerstein, she found half a letter from Dr. Sermai at Chapel, who was the musical guy at Chapel, to Oscar's, and he says, sending an arrangement, and says, make note of the lyric in this on page 2, and see if you agree to that change. We don't have page 2, so the assumption is that it's probably Oscar saying, okay, hold your head up high is as good a lyric and actually easier to sing.
So, well, that's what it comes down to, anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many songs in among the great songs that are very difficult to sing.
Right, right.
It's not just that you have to have somebody with a great voice and great personality and can act and everything else and be funny,
right.
But they've got to have some chops sometimes.
Also, as you know, when you write something and you either take pen to paper or a typewriter or a computer, you'll write something, you'll write. And then if you have reason to go back and look at it, suddenly the articles, the things pop out at you that you didn't quite occur to you when you first wrote it. Should that be an A or a the? Should I start with an and or a but? You know,
right.
And you can, it's like the role of the editor, which I think is disappearing too soon, but it's very important.
Here's another of the great songs that keeps getting recorded more and more, and it's a brilliant Oscar Hammerstein concept. I think Peter Stone is the one who talked about how he figured out how to get a really good love song in duet in early in the show before they're really in love.
The provisional love song.
Exactly. And it's people will say we're in love, and here's Ray Charles and Betty Carter.
Your eyes mustn't glow like mine. People will say we're in love. They're suspecting things. People will say we're in love.
You're listening to Singers Unlimited on WBGO. I'm playing some songs from OKLAHOMA, Oklahoma. Yeah.
Right.
And I'm with Ted Chapin from the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization. Now, the interesting thing, in Frank Rich's article in the most recent New York Magazine, is that there are other changes in the show in other productions. That there's the show with Curly played as a woman.
Yeah.
Not just by a woman, but as a woman.
Yes.
So the relationship is same sex.
Right.
And that's, you know, right now on Broadway, you've got King Glenda. And,
right, right.
And there have been so many other things like that. And we're talking about all this kind of casting switching
right,
around.
Right, right. There was a time a while ago where I wondered why Oklahoma seemed to be the one that people were focusing on. But then along came productions like the one that you were referring to in the Argonne Shakespeare Festival in Ashland. And I have to say, Bill Rausch, who directed it, who's a very interesting director and has been very good for that company. I knew him in the Crossroads Theater that he ran in Los Angeles. He wanted to do a mashup of Macbeth, Medea, and the Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella, which made no sense at all. But I thought, why not? And this was before the Broadway Cinderella. It was when Cinderella was, you know, we had a version of it based.
Yeah, but your Cinderella was very political.
Right, right, all right. But so this was when it was kind of generic, if I may. Please don't strike me down.
No.
So I knew Bill, but he approached me about this Oklahoma thing. He is, and I don't think he would mind my saying this, he is a gay man with a husband. They adopted two sons. And the second of their sons, when I went out there to see this production last summer, I was introduced to their daughter. This is a child who is transitioning as a teenager. So that clearly to this man, a smart director who I admire, the question of gender is very much part of his life. He was very nervous asking me about whether I would give permission for them to do this production where Curly is played by a woman. So Laurie's triangle is between the hunky guy who works on the farm and a woman. And then Ado Annie is Ado Andy. And he was so passionate. And I said, yes, you can do it. Please don't talk to other theaters about doing a co-production. And the other thing you'll be amused by is that they do a day every summer in Oregon that's sort of an AIDS awareness day, and they do a reading of a musical, and he asked if they could do this in his way at a reading. And I said, oh God, okay, but two things, don't tell anybody, and I wanna be there. So I flew out for it, and when I picked up my tickets, I'm foolish enough to have said to the woman, so what's the show this afternoon? And she said, I don't know. And if we know, then tell anybody, we're going to lose our jobs. Anyway, it was very, very interesting, and the audience liked it a lot. But it was very, you know, it's one of the things that I like, the point I like to make is whether we make the right decisions at the office, whether I make the right decisions, I so prefer having the conversation than being surprised.
Right.
And you know, there are a lot of judgment calls. It's not a yes or no, black or white situation. And, you know, what Bill did in his production in Oregon, it was a fairly traditional production of Oklahoma. Unlike Daniel Fish, you walked into the theater and, you know, you would be happy. You would see what you expect to see. And also, it was very well directed. The Aunt Eller, played by a transgender person, the first thing that happens is she comes out from the house onto the porch with a pitcher and opens the top of the butter churn and pours the milk into the butter churn. And I sat there thinking to myself, there are at least two generations of people who have no idea what a butter churn is.
Oh, right.
And I thought, good point. Pour the milk in, folks. That's the way you make butter. So, I mean, so it was a smartly directed production, which you had to deal with the gender issues because everything else felt familiar. And it was, it really was quite moving, and the audiences liked it a lot.
All these changes, sometimes it's just for the sake of diversity.
Right.
And sometimes it's meant to be socio-political or whatever. I just wrote a piece because six shows in the last couple of years have gender switched.
Yeah.
Including right now on Broadway.
King Lear
with Glenda Jackson. Yeah, but she's playing the sovereign.
Right.
She's not called Queen Lear.
Right.
But she's playing an angry sovereign. When she goes out and screams at the storm,
yeah,
she out-screams any Lear I've ever seen before.
I haven't seen it yet.
And anyway, the thing is, you don't think of Rodgers and Hammerstein and Shakespeare in the same breath, but they are.
They're considered classics. That's absolutely
true. Yeah, exactly.
True. But it's interesting. When I saw Bill Rausch's production at the Argonne Shakespeare Festival, I sat there thinking to myself, I'm not sure this could have happened 5 years ago. I think the gender switch that he made feels very of today. And that's, in a way, part of I think, the task of keeping these copyrights alive is to respond when there are things, as long as they don't tear the core of the show apart. These shows are pretty resilient, and I think, you know, they're not all great, and these productions, some of them are not good, but I think ultimately we win more than we lose. It'll be very interesting to see how this current Broadway production fares, because I think, you know, I mean, I've gotten some extraordinary emails from people who have seen it, I think quite interestingly, from actors who have just been blown away by it. And just love it. I mean, a couple of people have sent me the emails that you would expect.
Are you nuts?
Right, exactly. But I thought that, you know, first of all, actors, there are smart actors. I think the world tends to think of them as not so smart. But I think smart actors are really fascinating. And they have pretty good instincts about what works and what doesn't work.
We'll talk some more about that. Here's again that great song, the Provisional Love Song, and it's a new recording from Cat Gang on WBGO.
Don't sigh and gaze at me. Your sighs are so like mine. Your eyes mustn't glow like mine. People will say we're in love. All night with me till the stars fall from above. They'll see it's all right with me. People will say we're in love.
That's from Cat Gang, and that's People Will Say We're in Love.
So I have a question for you, Michael.
Let's have it.
Agnes DeMille hated that song, and it is in nowhere in the dance music of Oklahoma. Why do you think she didn't like that song?
Why?
I don't have no idea. But it's funny. This morning I was looking at a book, her first book, in which she says, you know, I heard that song and thought it was a bad song and never wanted to use it. And I mean, maybe she's from an era where a provisional love song, she just thought, say it or don't say it. Maybe that's the,
Actually, you have these two characters who are antagonistic from the first.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they're singing a love song.
Yeah.
And that's the whole point. But the love song seems to be like they're crabbing at
right.
each other.
Right, right. It's just curious because and she's not here to ask, but I just thought that was kind of fascinating.
Does she ever go to shows and say, they did too many jetés over there, you know,
I don't know. I probably have said in one of the other programs I was here about a rapprochement that I did with her late in her life, because she, you know, she was angry for years that her role in Oklahoma and Carousel, what she felt very strongly, it was more of an author's role than just a steps role. And she was right. And so, you know, thankfully to Dorothy Rogers and Bill Hammerstein, they agreed to let me go and offer to pay her for her contributions to both of those shows. And my meeting with her at her apartment was a meeting I will never forget. She didn't quite trust. At one point she said to me, does Dorothy Rogers know you're here? And I said, yes. And she looked away.
She used to go on Dick Cavett's show and she took no prisoners.
Yeah, absolutely. I did find out, which I thought was kind of sweet, after that visit with her where I had lined up what deal we were going to offer her. So it was a very pleasant meeting. And I found out later that she called my father, who she had known, and said, your son came to see me today. He may be the first gentleman who ever walked into the Rodgers and Hammerstein office.
The first gentleman.
First gentleman. She was very pleased with that. And my father told me that, which I thought was kind of sweet.
Speaking of dancing, I went to see I Married an Angel, which is an encore, and they do wonderful shows. And I'm watching this show, and I'm saying, like, there's just too much dancing in this show. And then I realized I haven't read programs.
Right.
So I want you to open the curtain
right.
and show me what
right.
you got.
I'm here. Take me.
And it's really a show. The whole point of the production was this is the Georges Balanchine classic ballets.
Right.
And that's the story. The story is in the ballets. The whole right. point of the show is the ballets.
Right.
And that's my blind spot in the arts. I just don't get it.
Right. No, it's, you know, one of the things about the Rodgers and Hart shows, I keep referring to them as the sitcoms of their day, because the ideas of the Rodgers and Hart musicals, even more so than the Gershwins and the Porters at that time, they would take these surprising, weird ideas, you know, and in that instance, you know, for Vera Zorina, who he was about to be married to, I think, I'm not sure, somewhere in there, Balanchine, she was a wife of Balanchine, and to create, you know, create and put a in a musical a woman who was a ballerina, not an actress, and God knows not a singer. On Your Toes, similarly. But then, you know, in On Your Toes, Rogers wrote Slaughter on 10th Avenue, which, you know, if it's to put that in a musical as something for a ballet dance, that's not bad. Unfortunately, I Married an Angel doesn't have a Slaughter on 10th Avenue.
No, it's Slaughter on 10th Avenue. The guy's dancing to keep from being shot.
Right.
I mean, there's gangsters in the wings.
Right, but a plot.
There's something happening.
And plot.
Here she's an angel, and it's just like, what?
Yeah, no. I loved seeing I Married an Angel at Encores, and as you just said, it's what the Encores program was started for, to do shows that we're not going to see revived on Broadway, just to get a sense of what it was like in another time. You know, the music, full orchestra, songs that I don't want to say not top drawer Rodgers and Hart, but some of them were, you know, a little bit of a notch below, but they're given the full treatment, you know. And when the overture, in the middle of the overture, it'll cascade into, you know, How to Win Friends and Influence People,
right.
And people don't know that song, but it's a peppy, you know, it's a peppy dance tune.
And there's one classic for sure in the show, Spring Is Here,
right.
And the title song is pretty
right.
good here on WBGO.
Once there was a thing called spring, when the world was writing verses like yours and mine, all the lads and girls would sing when we sat at little tables and drank May wine. Now April, May, and June are sadly out of tune. Life has stuck the pin in the bone. Spring is here. Why doesn't my heart go
down? She's sweet and gentle, so it isn't strange when I'm sentimental. She loves me like an angel. Now you've heard I married an angel. This beautiful change will be awful good for me.
Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong, a couple of Rodgers and Hart songs, and couldn't be any different, more different lyricists than Lorenz Hart and Oscar Hammerstein, working together with both of them with Richard Rodgers.
And the fact that he could switch gears halfway through his career and write very different music. I mean, there are people who prefer the Rodgers of Rodgers and Hart to the Rodgers of Rodgers and Hammerstein, but I think it's fair to look back and say that what he and Oscar Hammerstein created, I mean, I tend to say it's why I've had a job for so long. The theater, the shows that they wrote are rock solidly constructed, and that's part of why they can be done again and again and in some very different ways, and people still respond.
Ted Chapin with me, and always good to have you. Oklahoma nominated for 6 Outer Critics Circle Awards. I get to vote for those.
Very good.
And the Tony Awards will be, the nominations will be announced on Tuesday.
They will be.
And you'll see how many you got going for
Well,
that
we know tour. It's a revival. It's only one of 2 revivals. So it's
exactly.
a pretty sure thing that it will be nominated as a revival. But there's always the possibility.
It's a toss-up between, you know, Kiss Me, Kate, and
which couldn't be 2 more polar opposite productions.
No. But the twist for me is that the Outer Critics, we vote for Off-Broadway also.
Right.
And Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish is one of the best shows I saw this season.
And I couldn't agree with you more, and I have no reason to, I cannot tell you why. I just found it so clear. The storytelling was so clear. I haven't seen it Off-Broadway, but I saw it twice downtown, and it was kind of astonishing.
Yeah. And then Stephen Skybell, who plays, is the best Tevye I've ever seen.
Because the thing is, what I realized in Fiddler on the Roof, having seen the original, was it's actually not a play about a vaudevillian. Because that's what you sort of thought when you saw Zero
Mostel. Yeah.
And actually, I mean, I say this in a sort of self-deprecating way, but seeing the Fiddler in Yiddish was the first time I realized it's a story about a man with daughters. I have 2 daughters. And it's like, he's dealing with how to be a father for these daughters, each one of whom has her own very strong point of view about life and about her position in life. You know, and that they sing Matchmaker, Matchmaker, Make Me a Match, and all 3 of those daughters do not do what the matchmaker wants. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, and when we see productions of a show, we think we know, and something is illuminated that we didn't realize before. You know, that's what makes theater pump.
Well, you know, it comes down to, you know, you're arguing even with yourself, really, and then you realize, well, there's this and this, and, but on the other hand,
right.
And then you get to the point where there is no other hand.
Right.
And that's
right.
That's a powerful moment in that show.
Yeah.
There's a lot. I was crying at that show.
Yeah.
I don't speak Yiddish. You know, I mean, you can only read so far.
Right.
On the thing.
But of course, the funniest thing is, you know, the first line in that show, A Fiddler on the Roof, sounds crazy, no?
Right.
So Fiddler on whatever is Meshuggah.
Yeah, exactly.
And the audience, like Meshuggah, every New York, a member of every New York audience knows that word.
That's a great show. It's off Broadway, and it's Fiddler on the Roof of Yiddish, and it's got nothing to do with the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization, except that Ted Chamberlain and I both like it.
But it's theater, and we all have to love theater.
Absolutely.
And Joel Grey directed it. I mean, that's kind of amazing. And the original, one of the original putter-uppers of the Jerome Robbins staging, which I think is a lot of the success of that Yiddish, is that, you know, the Robbins staging of Fiddler on the Roof is so subtle, but so appropriate.
And then the bottles on their heads. The bottles. Nothing subtle about that, but it's like,
that's
how
true.
Are they doing that?
Right. But that's kind of it. But, yeah. You know, just the way tradition is done. Anyway, lots of things about that are great.
Oklahoma is playing at Circle in the Square, and you are right in the middle of it all, and they even serve you chili at the intermission.
And cornbread.
You're right. And there are many things about this show that I are extraordinary and thoughtful, and there are many things in the show that I did not like at all. But I mean, you know, it's a show that, from the very beginning, changed Broadway.
Right.
So, What the hell? Do it again.
And this production makes you sit up and take notice.
Okay.
And I applaud your comments about the fact that some things you will embrace and some things you don't. I think that's part of what makes theater.
That's what it's all about. And speaking of Rodgers and Hammerstein in Oklahoma, here's one more song. It's not the dream that's in this new production, but it's a dream. It's very dreamy from Karen Allison.
Out of my dreams and into you.